some silver bullets for post-launch. That will be great. So Edinburgh Israel will share some intel of how they made substantial progress at the University of Stirling. And Rolf Jonassonsson will add some reflections based on his substantial experience working on grants with academia industry. And then I will try to throw up the summary doc from the session and we can just put some feedback. And then aiming at starting with Eddie again on his focus presentation at around two.
I briefly improvise at least, so if you see me looking at my phone, it's just that I'm trying to look at my notes. So, almost 2 years ago, at the University of Stirling, my faculty was asked to take on as the Associate Dean for Research in my faculty. So, one of the first things that the faculty asked me to do was to attend a series of events where the agenda setters for the research councils were going to be. And one of the first ones I attended was a European-wide one, which was at one of those QA-focused interest groups. And it was really interesting. It was illuminating because one of the things that were what I found there was, first, a number of well-seasoned researchers who happened to, you know, attract most of the large grants there. You had academics who act as consultants for research councils. You have representatives from the councils there, and just kind of trying to discuss what are the challenges ahead. And one of the things that I think we as researchers have to become very conversant with is with the constant influxes in the research landscape. So, a while ago, research was predominantly an activity that was, you know, when you were putting together a grant proposal, it was basically proving your scholarship. It was just showing, you know, your theoretical prowess and all that stuff. Whereas now things have changed slightly, and we need to kind of be able to identify those trends and move along with those. So in that sense, I prepare a bit of a slide for the people in the faculty. And one of the first things that I was discussing, and this is predominantly has to do with two of the most important research councils that fund research in the UK for the Erasmus Mundus. I was just saying that to complement on what Chris was saying, you really need to look at the goals, but further, you really need to look at the priority areas of the councils as well. You really need to understand well what is it that the councils want to fund, and they could produce strategically documents that they will follow strategic plans for 4, 5, 6 years. So one of the first things that I did was I conducted a little bit of analysis when I took over as ADR. And one of the things that I found in the gateway, it was that most of the research that was funded was very clearly aligned with those priorities. And that was a really difficult sell to me to actually do to most of my colleagues. So because I appreciate that you really need to do what you like and what you love. But when you have scholars who are doing research on the use of comma and the text of Bertolt Brecht, for instance, that has perhaps no relevance to societal issues, is a very difficult pitch sell for a council. Okay? What I tried to do was say, okay, guys, this is the HRC strategic plan for 2013-2018, and you can see that it is not just about research for the sake of the arts, and that's it. No, there's an increased impact on arts and humanities research for cultural life and creative economy, stimulating economic and public benefit. So stimulating economic benefit was one thing that most of researchers are not really concerned with. You know, why are we asking, you know, us to do this? We're doing scholarship, you know, we're doing really valuable work, you know, and that's it. So they also talk about really interesting challenges, the challenges of working interdisciplinary and in the field and things like that, and being able to adapt to a fast-moving environment. But one of the things that I learned in one of those events was that if you think about governments trying to allocate funding for research, what you as a policymaker, you're trying to justify there is how are you going to invest the taxpayers' money in something that perhaps is not as relevant for the future of society or for the social well-being or for the economic benefits of that? And in that sense, this is a very useful framework. I'm sure that you are familiar with it. And it's this. Have you seen this before? Okay, so the UN Global Goals, believe it or not, it is not just the thing that everyone talks about in academia now. It is pretty much what everyone in policymaking is talking about as well. And this is a very interesting framework to me, because what happens is that what you do, you just go to this website, click in one of those priority areas, and there are targets that you can actually aim right to the core. And what happens is the difference between an academic that is presenting a grant proposal to a council and is not addressing any of that, and the academic that actually is saying, well, my research tackles UN Global Goal 8, in particular I'm looking at target number 7, which has to do with self-sustaining communities or, you know, gender issues or whatever. It is massive in terms of the assessment of the councils. It's massive, because it's actually proven that you are concerned about societal issues and not just your personal preferences. So use that. I strongly recommend that, because when I was there with policymakers, this is basically everything they were talking about. That actually makes a massive difference. So at the stages of conceptualizing your research, to me, I think you really need to take all these things into account. Now, I have also gone to the European funding type of meetings where they say, well, these are the four pillars, and these are our priority areas. By the way, social sciences and humanities have nothing to do there. I actually explicitly said, do we have anything to say there? And they said, no. You know, we are interested in engineering, in medical, you know, stuff, and arts and humanities and social sciences, not that much. So we're actually advised by the research office, the UK research office based in Brussels, to start lobbying for our field disciplines to be actually taken into account. That is a massive exercise. That's really difficult, and I'm not actually suggesting that you go to Brussels and start lobbying for, you know, fake news. We need to actually do this. But that's the level and extent to which a lot of researchers go in order to get a large grant. Just for you to consider, perhaps. You are the type of people that really like, you know, to go in and lobby, or that, you know, have some sort of more activist role in trying to shape the agenda of the research councils, or not. But just for you to consider it. So conceptualizing your research has that dimension. And then, sorry, yes.
No,
oh, 1 minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh gosh. Great. So then is grant development. So obviously, I've presented the priorities of the councils. If you are thinking about doing the research that you think is cool, it's great, and perhaps it's not really a societal issue, try to make it change a little bit and try to address those priorities. Talk to funders. That is something that I found was big, you know, massive in terms of sometimes we don't know what funder to approach, what council to go. And they're really open to just, you know, a call and says, look, I have this thing. Can I send you the objectives of my research and see whether you are the council that could actually... yeah, fantastic, yes. So they will send you an email saying, no, perhaps you should consider the social sciences instead, or, you know, the natural sciences or all the different groups. One thing that... I remember it was Chris was Edson. When you think about your progression as a researcher, think about that progression. And normally, if you're an early career researcher, perhaps the first type of funding that you should be creating is network type of research grants, which actually help you to first connect with a lot of non-academic stakeholders, be it from the government, from, you know, policymakers, and NGOs or whatever, that people can input back into the design of your research agenda and make it relevant to the councils. Because sometimes we as researchers are thinking about very conceptual stuff, theoretical, and when you bring into the mix of these people, they say, well, so let's just bring you down to earth, and let's just, you know, let's write it in a more appealing way, more directed to a lay reader. And then from there, after you have that, you have completed 2 years of research network, that you can build to a larger grant and say, well, this is building from this research network, and you already have a community of academic and non-academic stakeholders that actually can just redesign a continuation for a research agenda, which I think is really appealing to the councils nowadays. Also, that fits into the interdisciplinary that making of the group. I really like the figure of the research groups. Research groups, to me, are a fantastic way of building critical mass. And research councils love that. They don't want to see a project that is just advancing knowledge. They want to see that a project generates critical mass. That you have PhD attached to that. That you have research associates attached to that. Even that you are generating jobs to non-academic members, such as a project manager or perhaps an impact officer, someone who deals with the impact of your research, knowledge exchange activities and things like that. So think of your research project as a more organic and all-encompassing dimension. I don't know if I have much time, but let me just wrap it up quickly. I think just two things. One, you are not writing a book. You're not writing a piece of worthy scholarship. You're writing a sales speech. You're trying to convince and probably a non-academic to give you money to do a research project. So it needs to be written in a very clear terms and direct terms. And the other thing that I advise you as a friend, because I really, you know, really appreciate you, is rejection is a natural process of academic life. Build rejection as part of your process. So rejection is just another stage of the process where you get feedback. Okay? Once you build rejection, you're actually prepared for that, and it's just a matter of persevering until you get a grant, because you're going to get it. And that's it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's jump to Laurel and they introduce you more. Do you introduce yourself?
I can introduce myself. My name is Laurel Dickinson. I'm working here in Norway in a media innovation network based in Trondheim, which is the town where we have the technological university in Trondheim, Norway. And, network is designed to cooperate with this with science university. I am also very happy to serve for the VANIFRA, which is the World Association for News Media, serving as a board member there and heading a innovation initiative that they are working that they are trying to establish their position when it comes to research. So it was nice to hear you talk about these things, because one of my jobs there is to support initiatives and connect industry and academia. My background as an editor makes it possible for me to make use of some of my former colleagues and network. And it is my experience that it is very, very useful to have a personal relation when it comes to these things. Because the gap in culture between academia and media is substantial. I used to say that we have a very, very different meaning of what we are thinking of time, which is for people working in news media, at least they have a very, very short horizon when it comes to thinking of time, and that is very a difficulty in itself. What we are doing, the World Association of News Media is a big organization, it's a global one, and we have a lot of conferences all over the world. Actually, we have about 18,000 media objects that are a member of this organization, also through the national associations. And we've got some invitations to take part in, for instance, the Horizon 2020 program. And we are currently doing three programs there. We have applied for 6 or 7, so we have a rate of 40-50%, so we are very happy with that. But we also have the feeling to be invited very often to these some of these programs, because they know that we are going to be an organization and we are able also to direct companies and news outlets, news media into consortiums, and we do that. And there is also, of course, media organizations that are taking part in these programs outside our network. One of them is the APF, which is the Media Lab, which is the news agency in France.
Yeah.
We have a big media lab in Paris. And we are very happy with that, because Dennis de Soo, head of that media lab, he has taken part in development of a prototype to debunk false videos and photographs from social media. A prototype that is used now by more than 7,000 news organizations and also private organizations and people all over the world. Because there are, it's called INVID, a very successful one, and he's now working together with the University of Sheffield in an investigation how to debunk what we call deep fake, which is more sophisticated version of that. We have three programs for ourselves, just shortly mention what they are. There is a program called INJECT, which is done with the University of London and some Norwegian local news media, developing new journalistic tools. Right now we are working with Deutsche Welle and VRT, which is a Belgian TV company, on what we call CPM, that is a program for personalization in the news media. And I would say, as a remark to some of the discussions that we had before, that personalization is a big, big trend within media right now, and anything applying to that would be of high interest, I would say. And the third one is something that has just started with the University of Venice, Monday. That is about scientific dissemination in media, which is an interesting thing, because it's about how to publish, how to report on scientific work as it is. And I think give a little credit for the Commission in the EU that they are actually funding such a project. There's also a big conference for the scientific journalists going on in USAM in the beginning of July. It's a World Congress for scientific journalists, and hopefully they will come up with some resources when it comes to improve also their work, but also the relations to academia. So the industry is also trying to support some of the work that you do, not only in dissemination, but also active playing a part in innovation. That's it.
Thank you. We are happy that Wolf every now and then comes and listens to focus seminars by our fellows, engages in conversations about different objects, and sometimes joins for dinner, and we've been discussing different projects. We will be collaborating on the Global Data Journalism Conference, which Rolf and his team organizes with some of us here. Esther has been involved, and Roy and others, and this could be of interest to some of you, especially perhaps Liliana and Eddie, who work in the domain of data journalism, will be in the fall, and of course you will come back with more details.
So that will be in November.
In November, yeah.
Very good. So,
I'm sorry that I have to leave now.
I know. No worries. So before we give the scene to Eddie, could you just take a quick peek at this? Never show. Oh.
And tell me if there's something we should add.
Zoom. Well, I think if I zoom, you will only see parts of it.
Zoom.
Yes. one thing which Andy just spoke about, which builds on what I said, and I think he put it much better on the process print writing, adapt to the call, tailor to the call, but also, yeah, tailor to the priority of the funding body on your...
When did you do that? When did... Wow.
I would say, can I have one more?
Yeah.
Which I can say, but since you scroll down to grant proposal as a sales pitch, not a book, which I agree with. Like, one of the ways I've always thought, actually, we have a harder job in the humanities and social sciences versus the natural sciences, is they define their problem in a much clearer one-sentence way often. So, like, they'll be like, you know, we're investigating this new hub, this new balance, because it will cut our tax by 50%. Everyone gets it. It's weird. They have a really, like, a truth language in STEM subjects, really clear problems that they define and solve with, like, nice numbers that, you know, 45% can cut mortality by this, right? And I think one of the things I've always found useful to start, so many people spend so much time thinking about the acronym, which, of course, I guess might be important, but I also can find them in part useful way to spend your time is to think about, can you do the one sentence thing that makes you sound like the scientists basically, who are solving cancer, right? So like literally one sentence, what's the problem that you're, not just like the physical problem, but also like what your projects are. It's almost like you have to forward think what the solution could be. And if you can't do that in one to max two sentences, you don't have a clear enough
elevator pitch.
But even like, yeah, a very tight elevator pitch that's tied to like a problem that you have a societal benefit.
That's really right. What you were saying, if you don't get it in the first page, even in the first paragraph, I would say, you know, it's not effective.
Yeah.
That's good.
So I will share this with you in terms of kind of post-workshop reflections. You want to add anything, you're most welcome to do so. It's a work in progress. But we want everyone in the room to be successful with your grant projects and that we can resume and work together. So, Eddie, it's time for your focus.
Great, let me just...
presentation.
Thank you. So I'm probably going to take a little bit of time putting all the mic and all that stuff. So,
I thought it would be nice that we're kind of appearing halfway in this thing. Otherwise, if everyone kind of moves out, it looks like it's an empty. And I have seen that in some of our previous ones where the recording is there and it looks very empty, but people are sitting outside of it.
Hello.
Yes.
Is the transmitting? It's okay? Great. Okay. Fantastic.
So, briefly, by now, many of us here know this guy, but I will also talk to the camera. So it's a pleasure, on behalf of the Oslo Met Digital Journals Research Group, to welcome here Eddie Borges-Ray, who's a research fellow for the week. And following a number of presentations, both scheduled ones and non-scheduled ones, which I think were still very appreciated, we have now come to the main one, which is the focus seminar presentation in which Eddie will draw on several different lines of research that he has been doing over the last couple of years in building an agenda which helps us understand complex issues and going beyond perhaps our typical geographical gaze. And I think this is critically important, and Ed is super well suited to do so with his Latin American background, working in the UK and now moving to the Middle East.
Yeah.
The topic of the talk is Digital Journalists Beyond the West, Materiality, Performativity, Reflexivity, and Power. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Oscar, and thank you very much for inviting me to come during this week. It's been fascinating discussions and a great altogether week. So as Oscar was mentioning, what I'm trying to do in these 45 minutes is to take you through a bit of a journey, you know, through my research. And apologies if I'm sounding a little bit, you know, sort of pretentious. But I think, you know, that's kind of the thread that I will try to follow just to make some arguments that I've actually just developed over the years. So just a little bit about who I am. There you go. So I'm a former journalist slash PR practitioner slash producer, media producer. I worked in Venezuela and Spain for over 15 years. And then in parallel, I developed my academic career. And now I can say that I've done a little bit of scholarship over the years. And now it's going to be five different countries in three, four different continents, which is exciting. And at the same time, it provides me with really interesting insight about how things are in different contexts. My research area broadly revolves around these three issues: media, technology, and power. But in terms of my approach to that, I could say that it's a mixture of ethnography, which is one of the methodologies I enjoy the most as a former journalist speaking to people. That's kind of my thing. And I like to, you know, use data-driven storytelling and predominantly action research, you know, research that has an impact in specific community or society or collective, and using, you know, as a theoretical foundation, philosophy, mostly taken from French philosophy, which I really enjoy and liked. So I will start my discussion with a bit of some sort of introductory argument. I was reading Wire a while ago, as you can see, in 2015, and they were talking about the current state of affairs of artificial intelligence. They were interviewing a number of, you know, cutting-edge companies and top-of-the-game managers and CEOs. And this woman, who is the co-founder of Sense, Charlotte Galinsky, she was saying research is underway to allow computers to be able to recognize what is being said, understand what sounds mean, and recognize objects in a scene. Once we achieve these, there's the challenge of data fusion. We understand the world around us by fusing information from different sources simultaneously. This helps us to make faster, more accurate decisions, but it's still very difficult for computers. So to me, that was a really interesting statement. And in contrast, when we think about we as a journalist, this is the kind of way in which I perceive journalists now, journalism now, nowadays, you know? Even though that we have journalists who are performing really state-of-the-art technologies and trying to embed those into their journalistic practices, I don't know if you have watched this film, Moneyball. Have you watched it? Yes? If not, I'm afraid I'm going to spoil this little scene here. I hope you don't mind. So journalism in the 21st century still pretty much is based on normative conventions that were established around the 1920s. We still use, you know, similar codes of ethics. We still use, you know, the inverted pyramid as the cornerstone structural form of our stories. The most innovative technological embedment or adoption was computer-assisted reporting back in the 70s. Well, probably further in the 50s. And still reliant on this notion of nose for news. You know, there's some sort of esoteric thing that we develop as journalists over the years, and no one knows what is it. No one knows how do you develop that, other than, you know, over the years you will get it. And that scene in particular in Moneyball, that's this is the Athletics of Oakland. They have had a really kind of patchy seasons. The manager, Billy Bean, who is characterized by Brad Pitt, comes and has a meeting with them and says, okay, so we're going to start just discussing the new team, the setting of the new team. The new team, and those are the scouts. They are basically basing their decisions and their instincts and the guts, you know, feelings. They're like, we need someone who's like, you know, this and da-da-da. And he appears with a statistician from Stanford. He says, well, no, this guy is going to help us to come up with a new team. And all of these guys were like outraged. And I sometimes think that this is what happens when the first data journalist came into a newsroom, you know, talking about statistics. It was like, what are you talking about? It happens that this guy revolutionized sports forever. Now, sports is based in metrics, and you can see software that actually is just measuring the performance of an athlete. Interestingly enough, during my research on data literacy, one of the groups of more data literate individuals in societies are sports supporters, who are very fluent in understanding scores and averages and all that stuff. So just as some sort of introductory argument. So during the past 6 years, I have developed research in three predominant strands. The one that has been been building over the years for longer is a stream on data automation and journalism. Okay, that's the first one. The second one is a stream of research around data literacy, and more recently, I've been actually starting to look at issues of journalism in the Global South and non-Western societies. So I'll be talking about this a little bit. So start with data automation and journalism. I started in the realm of that part of research pretty much as most of the researchers of data journalism started, by just doing this very descriptive, to some extent, mapping of what is happening in specific either institutional context or national, regional context with, you know, data journalist research on Finland, Sweden, Norway, the States, etc. And to me, it was really interesting to see, well, actually, no one has done anything in the UK, who might actually believe this is the second stronghold for data journalism research in the world. So, okay, that's an opportunity. So I started doing research on data journalism in British newsrooms, predominantly mapping professional practice initially. And I thought, well, I will try to make this a little bit more theoretical relevant, and I will use this four lenses initially. So I wrote this piece for Journalism Practice, Unraveling Data Journalism, which has a relative success in the field, and kind of lay down, you know, the field of data journalism in British newsrooms. And then I produced this one for journalism, which was a little bit more theoretical and was looking at the small nations of the UK in particular, and looking at some sort of epistemologies of data journalism in those places. I conducted a number of semi-structured interviews to all these organizations, and you can see people like The Guardian, The Financial Times, but also a little bit more of regional, smaller newsrooms performing also data journalism. In terms of the theoretical grounding, what I wanted to do was to explore what I thought was some sort of multi-layer approach which helped me to understand a number of different dimensions, in starting with this some sort of materiality of data, which back then was something that everyone was kind of doing. You know, what is the materiality of data? And I was using new materialism and stuff like that. So I use Miller to draw some sort of distinction between that, what he terms a vulgar theory of mere artifacts, things as artifacts. And he claims that he goes beyond that to transcend the dualism of subjects and objects. And that they try to expand beyond that reduction conceptualization of data as just object evidence, which is basically when you think about journalists, data is just evidence that they place into the formula of a new story. I was also basing my work on Deleuze and Guattari, which, you know, Deleuze as I am, and I really like the idea of data as being a body without organs, you know, an entity that had a material strength and that was able to actually govern the lives of people. And I think you perceive a little bit of that when I was explaining my research on data literacy yesterday. So in the same way as Manuel de Landa, another philosopher, mentions that evolution is an immaterial force that drives the destinies of humans, I think the data has similar implications for not just data journalists, but for us as human beings. So I ultimately use Kuhl and Frost, where they talk about matter, that, you know, something that is more than mere matter. Is an excess, a force, a vitality, a relationality, or difference that renders matter active, self-creative, productive, productive, and unpredictable. So I really use that some sort of framework to discuss the materiality of data. I also liked very much Marcel Breuer's idea of the performative power of journalism. And he says that the performativity of journalism relies on norms and discourses used by journalists to impose their constructed truths on the public. And complemented that with Baudrillard, who also thinks that, for instance, news are the result of a previous election, a montage that has been already tested, reality through questions that provide scenarios of regulated opposition whereby nothing really occurs by mere chance. And as a former journalist, I kind of agree with that, because when journalism, although that things seem to be live or, you know, spontaneous, everything has been very, very pretested and controlled. And then in terms of reflexivity, which was looking perhaps not just at the professional practice, but also at, you know, the mindsets of journalism, that is something that ultimately has obsessed me, just, you know, how journalists deal in terms of their thought processes with everything that they are doing. So I use Alvinson Skolder cited by Lamy. When they say the reflexivity is the way different kinds of linguistic, social, political, and theoretical elements are woven together in the process of knowledge development through which empirical material is constructed, interpreted, and written. And obviously, as a Foucauldian, again, French philosophy and sociology, power, and looking especially at notions of power relations, strategies of struggle, you know, power relations as those that are imposing some sort of form of power and those that are resisting those. So in my two studies, I came up with the following findings. I saw that data journalism, more than being a form of reporting using data, was journalists trying to create some sort of informational experience, which users will, to some varying degrees of interactivity, enjoy. To me, it was interesting that the materiality of data was predominantly mediated by regimes such as the Freedom of Information Act. And although we tend to think that that's a positive thing, actually really constrains a lot of journalists who are trying to move away from that and escape from heavily politicized data to alternative sources that will give them exclusives that others are not pursuing. So in that sense, data seems to be mediated by ideals of alleged openness and transparency, subject to the bureaucracy and politics of public institutions. It covers themes such as conscripts to public governance, health, education, or crime, which is quite constraining and restricting. And then it's usable as long as it's provided in a machine-readable format, which we have heard in data journalism research that is the predominant issue that data journalism faced. To me, it was interesting that wave scrapers and other automations were starting to become institutionalized as an alternative to these. One of the things that to me was striking is that data journalists perceive data as a claimable material object. So it's something that they will claim, and then that will become theirs. Either used as evidential input in stories or as data-driven outputs. But it was predominantly dependent on the agency of either journalists or interviewees who will provide the necessary context to data. So data was unable to act in itself. But in some instances, I found people that reported that automation were becoming examples of data exhibiting secondary agency. You know, we're actually enablers to the journalist activity. In terms of performativity, I thought the performativity of data journalists were mediated by a number of indicators, such as journalistic authority first and foremost, numeric infallibility. They will use in numbers as, you know, truth claims that were validating their claims. Scientific rigor as another means to provide authority to their claims, and computational as, an assume or a perceived computational neutrality. And they were also relying on different forms of collaboration and cooperation, intra and extra newsrooms. To some extent, they were talking about the ideal of crowdsourcing data, which in the end didn't really happen. And all of them exhibited quite hyperlocal empathy. They were thinking that the interesting part of producing data-driven stories was to go to local councils and local authorities and extract information that was never used, and actually talked a lot about the identity of specific small communities. I started to see the form of diversification of data journalism. In the past, you know, data journalism was pretty much a specific format. And I saw that, for instance, The Guardian had the data blog, which produced quick daily turnaround, generally visualized brief forms of data journalism. But also other investigative journalism units were actually doing extensive, thoroughly researched investigative forms of data journalism, like the ones we saw in the Panama Papers, for instance. But at the same time, in the UK had a very unique example of data journalism, which was called AMPT. And they had, you know, this very light, almost comedic, entertaining and gamified, editorialized form of data journalism, which was well regarded by very, very serious data journalists that in the end disappeared, sadly. In my second paper, I produced this, which I think now forms is the basis of analysis from another colleagues. But I was trying to use all the different epistemological claims made by previous research and try to create this some sort of spectrum and position each one of those claims into that continuum. On the one end, there was some sort of more news hound paradigm, you know, people that were using data journalism to produce, you know, the kind of some sort of very old school investigative journalism. And on the other hand, there was some sort of more techie paradigm, which, you know, was people trying to do more some sort of entrepreneurial, you know, computer assisted, you know, heavily engineered type of data journalists. And in between, the work of people like Parassi and Coddington and Gainild as well. So then, for a Future of Journalism conference, Florian Stauff and I worked on this piece. We thought, okay, every time we go to the Future of Journalism conference, someone comes with an article about the future of something. So, well, let's do the future of data journalism. Let's see whether it's a practice that could be sustainable. And for that, we use a scenario network mapping, which is some sort of future studies methodology used to predict potential outcomes. And it was looking at the hierarchy of causes, the roots. And to that, we did an in-depth reading of previous literature, both professional and academic, on data journalism, and a hierarchy of outcomes, the branches of the potential scenarios. For that, we interview what we believe is la creme of creme of data journalism. Liliana is not there because she never responded to my email, but we approach her because we think she is also part of that group. But you have people like Emily Vail, Simon Rogers, Alberto Cairo, Pro Brosha, Nicholas Kayser, Braille, Mirko Lorenz, Elena, and the list is quite extensive. And they provided very, very insightful and interesting arguments and discussions that we kind of, because of time constraints and space constraints, we produce as three potential scenarios. The first scenario for us was that data journalism as a skill set will soon be regarded as a basic and essential form, essential for every professional journalist as well as journalism education. And we argument that through the different testimonies that were provided to us. In scenario two, data journalism as a genre will remain a niche storytelling format, but will ultimately find its way into smaller newsrooms due to decreasing limitations. In scenario three, due to financial and personal limitations, data journalism will be abandoned by the mainstream media who will outsource data analysis to non-legacy actors. From these analyses is when we started to notice that, and I think you have done a lot of research on this, outsiders and interlopers as well, is the non-legacy, the role of non-legacy actors in data journalism. In particular, to me, is the role of Google, for instance, in funding a lot of initiatives through the Digital News Initiative, that like the Bureau Local, for instance, and other data journalism related initiatives such as the Data Journalism Awards, and the role in this. I was kindly invited by Scott and Bob Franklin to write a book chapter for the Routledge Handbook of Developments in Digital Journalism. And I produced a book chapter was called Data Journalism as Platform, looking at the architecture, agents, and protocols. And as you know, as always, I like to find a new methodological approach that is, you know, interesting. And I went to the MIT page of platform studies that Bogost and Montfort edit. I thought, well, that's a very interesting methodology. Basically, what you do is you look at this multi-layer approach. You look reception, operation, interface, form, function, code, and platform. The only problem was that the way they apply this is to devices like a computer or the Nintendo or the Kindle. So we're thinking, well, what I'm trying to understand here to study is actually a social technological practice. So Apple Ray and Parika said that on the research that you can actually apply this methodology to, you know, socio-technical practices, coming up with interesting findings. And I just give it a go. So in terms of the interface, and echoing Esther's research on interactivity, I found that it was some sort of illusion of control. You know, the interface gives you this some sort of sense that you are in control, but you are actually subject to a finite set of options that are being designed to you. So I basically concluded that since this interface does not distinguish between digital objects and users, human agency is parameterized as another variable governed by system protocols, another command line in the code, which actually was interesting to actually detach yourself a little bit from the humanness of data journalism, the emphasis that we always have had in research on data journalism, the human doing data journalism, looking at the whole platform as an infrastructure. In terms of form, I concluded the specificity, the specialized knowledge base, and its disruptive nature suggests that data journalism seemingly works better as an alternative methodology or philosophy that adapts to journalistic themes or beats to provide both a robust backbone to stories and tools to efficiently make use of web-based knowledge infrastructures, which challenges a little bit the idea that data journalism will be pervasive and will become normalized. In terms of code, I thought the optimum reflexive and performative state of data journalism practice emerges when a nose for news and computation cognition blend to generate a hybrid form of journalism. And we're starting to see more and more this type of hybrid professional, which is both competent in journalism and computing, code, Python, and all these type of practices. In terms of operation, it was an interesting thing that I then revisited in another article that was published recently, is the idea of this invisible user. So despite expectations of cooperation, which will bring data journalism and members of the public together as companions in the quest for uncovering data insights and exposing corporate and governmental wrongdoing, in reality, citizens are more likely to only come into contact with data journalists as digits in the database underpinning data-driven news pieces. So that ideal of crowdsourced cooperation really never fully realized. And finally, in terms of the platform, the constant power interactions between power brokers, non-legacy civil initiatives, and data literacy were things that I consider. More recently, worked together with my PhD student, B.C. Anderson, on a piece that was published in Digital Journalism as well, which has to do with UX design and user interface design. And the interface as the point of encounter between data journalism and their imagined audiences. You know, how data journalists think of the ways in which users will interact with their with the stories and the options that they produce for them. So this was published as part of Esther's, Guse and Arden's special edition on data journalism research studying a maturing field. It was, again, based on some instructor interviews with all these people, in particular, people doing this type of interactives. I don't know if you have played the Uber game, which is a very interesting data journalism piece, which is some sort of gamified decision tree type of data journalism artifact. We produced this some sort of spectrum, again, between author-driven and the explanatory function of interactive data pieces and reader-driven and exploratory function in the type of different formats. And also quite, you know, complex comparative analysis between different formats and different forms and functions. I was very lucky to be invited to the next iteration of the data journalism handbook. Oh, sorry. There you go. That's there. Edited by Liana and Jonathan Gray. And in this case, because I told you there was a bit of obsessed with this idea of what happens with the reflexive dimension of data journalists, I started working with this idea of computational thinking that is quite prominent in data journalism scholarship. But at the same time, I wanted to explore a really interesting theory that colleagues in Sterling are developing. Philosophers Anderson, Wheeler, and Spivak are talking about this idea of distributed cognition, the idea that cognition now spreads out over the brain, the non-neural body, and environment consisting of objects, tools, and other artifacts, text, individual groups, and other social institutions. The idea that data journalists no longer have all their knowledge stored here in their heads. You know, they're using a number of artifacts and other computationally mediated actors and actants, and you know, in terms of produce their stories. I also base, because I am also an ethnographer, my kind of claims and discussions on interviews with Francesco Marconi from the Wall Street Journal, Mervyn Bakbakar from Full Fact, and Alan Rembig from Arts Media. They're working in very interesting automation-driven research, data journalism development. So in the pipeline for this type of research, at the moment I'm producing a long monograph for Routledge called Journalism and Data, Tensions and Intersections, where I'm discussing critically the practice of journalism in conjunction with on interaction with data. I have done research, for instance, in the Library of the Congress in the United States, and delve quite deep into to find the first form of data ever in a American newspaper, and that was the Boston Newsletter, and you can see a little table with people that disappeared during shipwrecks and the colonial era. I'm also working on a short monograph for Routledge Serious Disruptions on automated journalism, and working with two different projects on data journalism, trying to map in data journalism practice both in Vietnam and in China, which are really generating interesting and very, very interesting insights. In particular, one thing that I would like to highlight is that the theoretical foundations that we have developed to analyze and understand data journalism no longer are applicable to these sociopolitical environments. And therefore, we need to really start thinking about in what ways we understand places where, you know, self-censorship is something that is practiced by journalists every day, and still they produce data journalism. So data journalism in countries such as Vietnam and China obviously don't respond to, perpetuating democratic values in the same way as in Europe or the States. So in here we need to really understand in what ways data journalism works and actually competes with other forces that we don't have in the West. For instance, self-media, YouTubers, celebrities like doing data journalism in China, for instance, or companies like Tencent, the Googles and the Facebooks of China producing data journalism at the back of the data they produce from the users, which also compete with mainstream media news organizations. So that's really interesting developments that are happening there. So in relation to my data literacy research, you saw a lot of what I have produced yesterday is predominantly based on a project that we got funded that finished last year called Life in Data. It's co-directed with my colleague Greg Singh. We tried to reach a multi-sectoral conceptualization of data literacy, and we actually acted as consultants to support the Scottish government. We worked with a series of stakeholders and communities of interest, and we're trying to use some sort of format and export it to other different countries to respond to the different necessities that data literacy can actually help to solve. For instance, in Mexico is the liberalization of the energy market, which actually is just bringing a lot of questions, and users are starting to deal with the ways in which they have to, interact and deal with energy. Vietnam, for instance, in terms of farming and fishing, in China, cybersecurity. So we organized a series of events which looked at answering different levels and different questions. And I'm going to just to show you some of the questions that we had for each one. The first workshop was called Mapping Data Life. And the question was, how can we better embed data literacy within the open data strategies of Scottish cities? The second one was called Mapping Data Literacy, which was one that emerged out of the blue. That's why it's called 1.5. It was one that we never devised. But we really quickly came to the realization that different stakeholders had different understandings of what data literacy was. Therefore, we had to really come up with a working definition that was usable for all of us. The third, which was actually the second, was called Uncovering Data Awareness. And the question was, what are the minimum competences or knowledge bases necessary for citizens to engage with data in everyday life? Third one was called Big Ideas from Small Cities. And this idea of data driving smart cities was always based on small, big urban centers. But what's happening in small communities and little towns where data is also having an important role? So that was basically the questions that we were trying to address there. How can data literacy enhance our understanding of the places we live in and our sense of community and belonging? The fourth one was called Bringing Data to Earth. And we thought that we so far have been talking about data in very abstract terms. So if we really want to appeal to the general audience, then we need to bring the conversation down to earth. So that's exactly what we did. We invited a number of different stakeholders to present their work on data and gender inequality, for instance, or data and sports, data and place making, and I don't remember what was the four. So the question was, how do we better raise awareness of data and its role in engagement? And finally, we had this event which was called What I Know Is, and it was an international conference, an academic conference, where we actually tried to theorize all these findings. We work with all these project partners, many of them local Scottish organizations or international globalizations organizations like Wikimedia, which were really helpful during the project. This takes me to my last strand, and with this I wrap up my seminar. Looking at the type of research that I was doing in very local environments, looking at the international research that I was doing in non-Western societies, I start to think, well, we should be opening up a little bit more the grounds in other places to start understanding what's happening in other societies that are not necessarily functioning or necessarily addressing the same concerns that we have in our Western societies. So in that sense, I was invited by the Spanish journal Econo 14 to put together a special edition on Ibero-American data journalism. As you know, Ibero-America is composed by Latin America. It's composed of Latin America, and Spain and Portugal. And I asked my friends Bahare, Ravi, and Turuscali to help me edit this, which I think it was a first starting point to start a discussion about data journalism non-Western societies. But as things happen, I was also invited by, very generously by my now friend Bruce Musvario in Salvavawi to co-edit with them a Palgrave book on data journalism in non-Western societies to provide some sort of comparative perspective. And we have very, very interesting cases of data journalism from Zimbabwe, Rwanda, Nigeria, South Africa, China, Russia, Philippines, Iran, Kuwait, Argentina, and Chile, amongst more general revisions of what's happening in Latin America or the Middle East or Asia. And with that is the first book of now a commissioned book series called Palgrave Studies in Journalism and the Global South, which will actually address all these concerns, and we're inviting people to submit proposals. So I hope that gives you a bit of an overview of what I'm working in, the kind of the main arguments and things that I come up with during these 6 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eddie. I think the first question is, you say you've been working on four continents.
I believe so, yeah.
And I know I forgot to mention your involvement in Vietnam. I know you've been tutoring students, leading master programs, having things there while being in Stirling, while doing this thing. So my first question is, does your work day sort of operate on each continent on each day? So that's like 24 hours a day?
Well,
because this is very impressive.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, first I have to thank my wife. She's amazing, and she actually, without her, I wouldn't be able to really kind of do all this stuff and traveling this much. So that's predominantly the reason why I do this very crazy, you know, internet. But you're right. It's 24 hours. I have colleagues from China in Vietnam, in WeChat in China, and Viber in Vietnam, so different platforms, different types, and I'm receiving constantly texts, and I basically just wake up and add, you know, so it's difficult to manage, but you make it your kind of everyday life activity. Yes, and now we have collaborations in Australia as well, so yeah.
Good. All right, I'll open the floor for questions or comments. Obviously, several of your projects involve people that are present here.
Yeah.
Doing things for Liliana, doing things for Esther, editing a book series to which Esther, Roy, and I are contributing with
the With the after, and yes, exactly.
Many
the forward.
Other things.
Yeah.
So there.
Esther? Yeah.
I have a question about this book that you have co-edited around the discussion. Now, you started with saying that when you started doing the journalism research in the UK, you started mapping out and doing descriptive studies. And I guess those chapters that are included in the book are quite descriptive. And maybe they have to be in the beginning.
Hmm.
But having studied these chapters, do you see issues that are different in these countries that are important to study in relation to data journalism that you haven't done in the Western studies? So.
No, absolutely. That's a really good question. I think mapping new data journalism ecosystems is still necessary. That's some sort of, to some extent, descriptive research. And I'm not saying that within the book series we have predominantly descriptive, argumentative pieces, but, you know, really subtly methodologically as well. But I think those type of mappings are still necessary as we keep opening up, you know, different societies. When you start thinking about Africa, for instance, which is a new territory for me whatsoever, we have a very interesting number of chapters looking at the role of community actors in mediating data journalism, and also, you know, tech giants being very, very influential in, you know, in trying to get internet set there, and, you know, giving Google books and, you know, to people to try to amass more users for the business. So that some sort of power tension relation is really, really interesting. And, you know, I'm starting to see things that we don't see here. For instance, the role of data journalists in denouncing wrongdoing in communities, you know, quite, provincial, rural communities that are actually relying on data journalism to amplify their voices and say, okay, so, you know, government, you need to really act on upon this, and you're really, you know, keeping accountable, you know, the powerful, you know, the powers that be. So those things, you know, in Western societies, we take them for granted. You know, it's kind of the role of journalists to do this, whereas in there, it's actually as a matter of you know, death or life. I would say it's really, really important.
Thank you, Chris Peters, Professor Chris Gilbert. I'm saying it partly. I'm not sure if the camera sees you. And so that we speak loud also.
Thank you. Projecting too much this way. Okay, I'm just going to try to, because this is outside of my area of expertise quite a bit, so forgive me if this doesn't make sense, and then you'll make sense of it for me. But when you're talking about data, like I'm thinking back to like way back to Durkheim's work on like statistics, where mm-hmm. basically he, that's the sort of influential thing. His work, he shows how statistics become such a powerful thing for government. Mm-hmm. That you can sort of, once you can start mapping populations and quantifying them, you can actually have interventions and then change them. You can actually see how you put in sewers and death rates go down. Right? Yeah. That's like from the 1800s of the
yes.
century. Then I'm thinking of like, I don't know if you know, Bowker and Starr have this great book called Sorting Things Out, Classification.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
Like also showing how basically how quantification, vision, classification sort of have a fundamental impact on institutions.
Yeah.
So what I wonder about, and then like more recently like Lena Denchik and the data justice people, yeah. their work on showing how like predictive data collection mm. is sort of translated into policy and interventions. So what I'm wondering for journalism, mm-hmm. to what extent has this move towards data journalism almost changed the way the institution, or maybe it's just within data journalists, think of stories, mm. think of how they intervene and do their, like, does it have some sort of impact, this quantification and classing, that almost like sort of the identification and intervention into what sort of the journalistic process is fundamentally changes to that sort of level? Like, does it, and what are the sort of challenges therein?
Sense. Well, yeah, no, it completely makes sense. One of the things that we have seen in data journalism scholarship over the years, the professional and institutional constraints that data journalists face over the years, and starting from, you know, the 2012 and 11, you know, conception that the data journalist was the geek in the room that no one wants to talk to become now the go-to person to help me to interpret this data that I don't know how to use, you know? So collaboration inside the newsrooms have become a big thing. And that's some sort of institutional challenge is starting to kind of fade away to some extent. But to be honest, this is something data journalism operations are to some extent expensive, although and in spite of what another actors within the data journalism ecosystem or world are saying that, you know, everything is free. You can go and do, you know, stuff for free, you know, but to be honest, if you want to do really good data journalism, you really need to have certain competent level of numeracy or at least to have some sort of inclination to understand numbers, because numbers are very, very easy, or statistics are very easy to take out of context, and then produce really misleading reporting. So what you have now is that because there's so much data available that you can actually use and produce exclusive content, but at the same time, there's very hyper-local data that could actually help local journalists to appeal their local communities more closer than, for instance, The Guardian, you know, or BBC. There's an upsurge of data journalism practice within local news organizations. Not to say that then those data journalists can cope with the demand or the dynamics that, you know, as you know, are really challenging within small local newspapers.
I guess what I'm wondering is, it still sounds like there's resistance. Like, you can't have, to use your baseball example, you can't run a baseball team without an analytics department.
Yeah.
And you can't do government policy based on statistics. Hmm. Right? Like, all these sort of institutional changes where, like, the advent of quantification of data actually fundamentally changes the institution such that, like, you can't do it without. But it sounds like from what you're saying, data journalism is still.
Oh, right. It is. One of my interviews in my first piece, and you know, I'm not going to quote you who the person was. It was interesting because I was saying, so you as a data journalist, you feel that you should hold accountable data brokers like Google, for instance, or, you know, the ways in which, you know, personalization or scoring are being done in society. He says, no, that's not my role. My role is to get a data set and analyze it, produce a visualization if that's necessary, and that's it. That is the role of the technology correspondent or the politics correspondent or, you know, the business correspondent. We can work collaboratively, but we as a data journalist, we are not addressing those issues. Those are, you know, thematic things. My role here is to do is analysis of data. And I was like, really? I was really shocked. But that was basically the answer that I got in two or three of the big ones in the United Kingdom. Believe it or not, you know?
Other comments or questions?
Cool stuff, Eddie.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.
That's good. That's a way to put it.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you, Eddie.
No, thanks. My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you. just...
Yeah, you're really cutting edge, very innovative, very comprehensive in many, many ways.
Oh, thank you, yeah.
And it's also visible in the way Eddie does. We're taking a pause. I want to check the status of the coffee machines here. And I have a sort of a question whether we should go for this coffee if it's refilled or take a slightly longer break to go to another place to get coffee first. No?
No.
All right, so a shorter break.
Okay.
Maybe, now it's when we're such a small group, maybe we should move the tables like this. Because I realize it will be strange to sit.
Yeah, don't play all hide back there.
It's a coffee chat with Ava.
Yeah.
Just everyone huddle.
Well, I mean, I would totally appreciate it. I mean, it's not going to get rid of the camera, so. It's also been a long 3 days.
Yep.
It's a bit of an... At least, I mean, I have data, no thinking, so everyone can just, like, relax and chill.
Yeah, like the virtual view. Yeah. And also...
Nice. You can turn your brain off.
How do you say your last name?
Maya Hoefer.
Maya Hoefer.
All right.
Good. All right. Let's.
Diehards.
Is Eddie coming? We can start. He will come in the back, right? All right. It's end of the day, and we've listened to two fellow presentations today, and it's with great pleasure that we have Eva Meyerhofer visiting us from Roskilde University, where she's pursuing research on the very timely and important area of alternative news media, or other ways to reframe this. And we sort of headhunted Eva after meeting her at the disinformation conference in Aarhus, listening to her very relevant research, which aligns very well with several of the research group members here in Oslo Met. So we're delighted that you choose to take your time and come here and to have you as a fellow. And looking forward to listen to your presentation and also see what can come out of this in the long run.
Well, thank you. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I mean, I was very happy to be headhunted by Oskar on behalf of the entire research group because, yeah, I started researching alternative media rather recently and as I will show, I mean, it's not a gigantic research field yet, the research on right-wing alternative media. So, I'm happy to be here and meet you all. And it has been a fantastic 3 days. So I feel the pressure's rising that I have to come be the big conclusion. But since I've already shared quite a few conceptual thoughts with you on Monday, actually, in my symposium presentation, so I'm actually turning it a bit around. So now my fellow presentation is the empirical one, where the symposium presentation was maybe more conceptual. But that also means you can relax. It's more less thinking, more data. And what I'm going to present today is basically a research project I'm conducting with three colleagues at the Weizenbaum Institute in Berlin, which is sort of the German government's idea to, like, how do we tackle the challenges of digital society by having a new research institute, and we're looking at right-wing digital news ecologies in Europe and the US. But given that this is still a fellow presentation, and I'm very excited to be a fellow here, we discussed this actually over lunch yesterday, Eddie, whether we should have a That's Me slide. So I have a very reduced That's Me slide just to show you how I actually ended up becoming a scholar in digital journalism, because, I mean, that is my first project that I would call as sort of being related to digital journalism, but it still makes sense, at least to me, sort of the way how I got there. And how did I get there is that I'm a political communication scholar from Berlin, And I wrote my dissertation on elite cohesion and mediatized politics, which is attitudinal research, comparative research on the belief systems, the shared belief systems of political journalists, elites, elite political journalists, and political actors in different European countries. So this was where it started, but slowly I started actually to be more interested in the political journalist side of the entire game, and especially how you can understand journalists as elites from an elite theoretical perspective. Well, since I started drifting towards journalism, I was eventually ended up in a position that I have now as in journalism at Roskilde University. And I guess I was thinking, what does all of my research, what it holds together is basically sort of an interest in what maybe one can call the elite-non-elite divide in political journalism, right? Sort of what does it mean that we either have a group that we can sort of identify as elite, or that they call themselves as elites, or other call them as elites? What kind of implications do come from this for journalism and journalists? And I did a couple of research projects on that. The first one is sort of rather conceptual, sort of how do we understand journalists as elites from a theoretical point of view, and how do they form parts of larger societal elite circles. I'm currently also conducting research on mainstream media's positioning against or towards, sometimes against, fringe political actors, namely populist political parties in different countries. And now I'm working on a grant application on their take on Euroscepticists. And then what I'm going to present today, and what I also presented on Monday, is sort of the other side of the table. What is with them that are not part of the mainstream media or the legacy media? And what are, how can we conceptualize those, and especially the ones that I'm going to be talking about, right-wing alternative media actors? And I maybe must say sort of another sort of underlying theme in my research is that it tends to be comparative. I mean, I was really brought up in that comparative tradition of looking at context and how context shapes, for example, journalism, journalistic attitudes, and so on. Well, the project I'm going to talk about today is, as you can see from the title, on right-wing digital news ecologies. And we're focusing on six countries: the U.S., U.K., Germany, Austria, Sweden, and Denmark. I have some; they are not all of them, but some of the names that of these alternative media in these countries are on that map. And basically, what we argue is that, sure, I mean, right-wing digital news ecologies, they are larger. I mean, they also have other actors, for example, pundits, YouTubers, bloggers, parties, movements, but that these alternative media are like an essential part of these ecologies, and they become more and more important, and we can actually see this in many, many countries all over the world. Well, as I said, I mean, this is sort of an emergent research field to understand right-wing news outlets as alternative media. We've talked about this on Monday. There is quite some brilliant conceptualized work being done on how can you understand and these outlets as alternative media, because, as we discussed, this is something that people still react to. We don't really want to let go of our sort of nice concept of alternative media and sort of starting to think about how can we understand these actors from that perspective. So this is in the making. I mean, we heard from Caroline and Tine on Monday. And, well, there's a couple of country studies on digital right-wing alternative media in the U.S., in Sweden, in Norway, and also in Germany. But sort of these are, and as you can see from the dates, I mean, this is new stuff, right? But what is missing, we would argue, is the comparative angle. And so, as you see, I mean, this is, some of the stuff is rather basic, but it's really sort of, it's like groundwork, right? I mean, if we take this comparative approach and apply it to that phenomenon, where do we start, and what do we actually get, and what do we see? And we have two main avenues that we're taking. The first one is the question of context dependency. Sort of, I'm really sort of again, come from a tradition that is sort of very Hellenementini-ish, right? Sort of, there's context, and you can have context factors, and they will influence whatever is on the side of the dependent variable. And so we're going to go down that road as well. But the other question, and that's the second part I'm going to talk about today, is sort of the question of transnationality, right? So if we have a comparative angle, we're also in the position to look, okay, how do these ecologies in individual countries actually sort of start to interconnect and network? And I'm starting with the first stage, which was also the first stage of the problem, and that's the question of context dependency. And yeah, I mean, this is sort of a very reduced table of what it actually originally looked like, but I mean, we have six countries that we chose, basically sort of, okay, then we're taking two from different media systems. And now I said I'm a Hellenementini person, but as you can see, suddenly there is more media systems than Hellenementini would have us to have. And here we're actually building on Brueggemann and colleagues' work on that argue for that you actually have to separate the German-speaking Central European members of the democratic cooperativist model from the northern type. So we have two northern countries, Sweden and Denmark, Germany and Austria as the central type, and UK and US as the western type. And the very, very simplified argument that we make is that apart from sort of national idiosyncrasies and historical background, that it must have something to do with how established right-wing actors and positions are in A, the political sphere, and B, the legacy media sphere in a given country. And as you can see, obviously the reality is not it's not going to come out that nice and clean, but this is sort of an immediate assumption that you could think. Okay, if I think about Sweden and Denmark, I have a right-wing party or a right-wing populist party that is on the outside of the political spectrum, that is being ostracized or has been until recently by the other parties. There's a cordon sanitaire in the parliamentary sphere. And at the same time, the media will follow suit in a way. I mean, there has been the discussion in Sweden about, is there an opinion corridor? Is what is actually being allowed to be said in the media? We have had instances where mass media actors will sort of openly distance themselves from these actors. And an entirely different story in Denmark, where Danish People's Party, for example, is very established party in the political sphere, and also, as Richard has continuously shown, where you can say pretty crazy right-wing stuff in legacy media and in contrast to for example, Sweden. A similar story goes for Germany and Austria. Germany would be sort of be aligned to Sweden, where we have the AfD at the fringes of the political spectrum, and also the mass media being very delegitimizing against these actors. In Austria, again, the Freedom Party being in government, and the mass media, especially tabloid media, being much more forthcoming to right-wing positions. And then we have the UK and the US. And the story gets a bit tricky. Because, yeah, of course, in the UK, I mean, if you think, okay, we don't have... There's no right-wing or right-wing populist party that has a visible role in parliamentary politics, but we've all followed Brexit, right? I mean, it's not that these positions do not exist in the political sphere. So, yeah, technically, yes, there is not a party that sort of represents that, but so it's a bit in between. But again, what we argue is in the mass media sphere, and it's also been shown in research that the mass media is rather very forthcoming towards these positions and actors. And in the U.S., again, I mean, is the Republican Party is not a right-wing populist party, but I guess we would call Trump a right-wing populist. So I put them in italics. So yeah, we have sort of these positions that are in the political sphere, that are visible in the political sphere, and also in the legacy media sphere. So what we would expect, very schematic, would be, okay, the incentive or the potential for right-wing alternative news ecologies to form would be largest in countries like Sweden and Germany, where they are not represented in the mainstream, where the potential would be less in countries like Denmark and Austria, where it would simply be, okay, you don't need this alternative necessarily. And the UK and US being sort of, especially the UK, a bit of a question mark, where we had argued in the paper that we wrote on it that it actually sort of, that we see a large potential, but as you also will see later on, that's actually that hypothesis at least didn't hold. And for the U.S., we would actually see a low potential, and that's also something that you will see is not necessarily going to happen. So basically our idea was U.K. would be more prone towards these ecologies than the U.S., and But before we even could start that, so the question was, okay, how do we actually empirically identify these alternative media, right? Because it's one thing if we do this nationally, but if we do it internationally, we kind of have to be a bit more systematic. We can't just go and know, okay, we know the five. You know, it's like a sort of like, you know that when, you know it when you see it in your country, you know, maybe not in the US because there's quite a many, but in Denmark, definitely we know who these people or who these sites are, but, what we did is in the first step, we basically started compiling names, right? I mean, so we looked to the literature, we talked to country experts, we talked to civil society organizations that monitor right-wing extremism, we looked at fact-checking sites, and we just started compiling names of sites and had 150 in sort of the larger sample in six countries, which we then assessed based on four criteria. And the first one was, is it a text-based online news site? I mean, text-based basically just because that is practical reasons that we didn't do YouTube research, right? I mean, there's obviously a big part that we're not looking at. But more importantly, an online news site in that sense that we sort of assume or think that it still needs to have some sort of rudimentary element of institutionalized journalism, right? Sort of that they at least self-declare as a news outlet in some form, that they have the layout that sort of mimics or matches a news site, that they maybe have some sort of, vocabulary on editorial responsibility and so on. I mean, the bar was very low, but that basically means we're not looking at blogs, right? The second, is it alternative? And this now taking that you already accepted my premise that we can call them alternative. And here we looked at their self-positioning, right? I mean, do they self-describe as alternative? Do they have any kind of, but we're taking again a very broad approach, if there's any indication that either on their social media accounts or on their website that they will sort of have that they will position against the establishment, that they have these sort of catchword and phrases that you then see sort of retelling the truth, or this is where the real truth is. We would still say, okay, this is some sort of indication that they're positioning themselves against the perceived mainstream. The question, is it right-wing? Turned out to be a really tricky one. And, I mean, we're still wavering. I mean, we started out calling them far-right, as you do. I mean, some of these, and technically many of them are, but, I mean, but some of them are sort of, it's a question, when does far-right start and when is it just right-wing? What we did was to look at, again, at their website, at their homepages, at their about sections and their categories. Do they have any indication of ideological strands that are associated with right-wing, like nationalism, authoritarianism, nativism, fascism? But also if they self-declared as being anti-left-wing. So if they say, okay, we hate the left, we said, okay, you're right-wing, for example. And that is obviously, But the information is not that that abundant on these sites, so we also had to be practical. And just a side note on this. What's happening now? Yeah. Because what we often get is then, are these right-wing alternative media populist media, actually, really? So isn't this actually right-wing populism? And this is sort of the same question, like, aren't they actually fake news media? Sort of, are they populist media? And the short answer is no. I mean, of course, they share the anti-establishment impetus that with the populist agenda, right? But that's because they're alternative, I would argue, not because they're populist. And so there's an analogy that you can see, but I would say that for them to be populist media, I mean, this is an empirical question about their rhetoric, about their appearance, about their content, whether they apply populist rhetoric. So I don't find it helpful to also give them the label populist from beforehand, right? So I think for us as journalism scholars, it's more helpful to then stick to the term of alternative media and place the anti-establishment focus there. If you're familiar with populist theory and populism, I mean, it's called a thin ideology, right, that can latch on to different thick ideologies, and just as alternative media latch on to ideologies, in this case, right-wing ideology. Yeah, and finally, they had to sort of be clearly placed in one of the six countries under study, so we're not including transnational outlets. And we ended up with 70 right-wing online news sites in the final sample. The first thing we thought was looked as very, very basic, actually, supply and demand structures. Sort of the argument being that this is the first element of what has been called the political information environment in a country. We first of all, I mean, the numbers of homepages that we found sort of are the first indication of how many we actually find. We also looked at the average number of articles, sort of the activity levels on these sites, how many articles do they publish on their websites based on a Media Cloud database, this is RSS feed, based harvesting, and how many tweets do they send in a given reference month. And what we can see is, I mean, that the story that I told you about the context dependency holds rather well for the Nordic countries. I mean, we did find, even though I know, I mean, the number of homepages included is a very crude indicator, you know, and obviously very much dependent on the size of the country. But still, I mean, I can argue that Sweden and Denmark can get compared, and we did find significantly more sites in Sweden than we did in Denmark. If you've been very attentive to my presentation on Monday, you may remember I had more Danish sites on Monday than I now have. So what happened to the remaining three is, I mean, this is a year old, right? So, I mean, this is really, really in flux. So this, I mean, you probably, all these numbers are not true anymore. And because this is a very dynamic environment. But also because, for example, we didn't include Document, which is a Norwegian site that has a spin-off, has a spin-off in Denmark for this study, because we then argued from our criteria that it was a Norwegian site. I guess right now, today, 1 year later, you would call them a Danish site because they have the infrastructure in Denmark that allows us to speak of a Danish site. But that explains why the numbers are a bit different. And the Swedish sites are much more active than the Danish ones on their website and on Twitter as well. In Germany and Austria, the story is only half true. The German sites are, as expected, more active than the Austrian sites. But as you can see, we have found 8 Austrian sites and 10 German sites. There's quite many Austrian sites, and we were surprised by that. And I'll have an explanation in a minute. And for the UK and US, the UK site, very few UK sites, that were significantly less active than the ones in the US, where we found 36 sites, and that's already excluding regional sites. And Christian sites, which we excluded because we felt that that would be an unfair comparison, because it's a very specific US phenomenon, this massive group of Christian alternative news sites. Well, on the demand side, we looked at the Alexa rank, which is we did not use ComScore measures. We did not use unique visitors because some of these sites are so niche that you simply can't. I mean, this was the best indicator we could have. It's a rank. They rank based on unique visitor data, the sites in the country for relatively to each other. And we looked at average Twitter followers and Facebook subscriptions again in June 2018. What we can see is that in Sweden, all of the 8 sites that we had information on, they were actually in the top 1,000 in Sweden. And again, I'm aware of that. Obviously, it's much easier to be top 1,000 in Sweden than top 1,000 in the US. But this is, you have to bear with me on this one. I mean, this is the indicator that we can have. But while in Denmark, none of them rank very high. And the same is, again, in Germany. More sites were among the top 1,000, 3, or the top 5,000, 3, top 1,000, 6, top 5,000, and in Austria it was less. For the rest, I mean, to cut a very long story short, I would argue that the Twitter and Facebook demand that we see has nothing to do with the context that we're looking at. It has something to do with how social media is being used in different countries. I mean, for example, in Denmark, Twitter is literally not used for these sites. You know, so they had an average 93 followers, the numbers are much higher for the UK and the US. And as you can see, apart from the US that sticks out in so many ways, Facebook subscription numbers are actually rather similar. more of a mixed picture here. And one reason, if you see there's arrows popping up, is because, there is this, the one factor that is decisive are the transnational audiences. Right? I mean, if you look at the audience profiles, the Austrian sites are being read by Germans. So that explains why there are so many Austrian sites, and the UK audiences read the US sites. And it's also because in our study, Breitbart features as a US site. So Breitbart UK is in a US site, and that's what what covers, sort of, apart from pundits, the market in the UK, pretty much. We also looked at something called organizational strategy. But again, we did not do any interviews. So we looked at the websites and thought, can we discern some sort of idea of how they want to position themselves in that ecosystem? And we looked at three things in particular, very basic, right? I mean, is the website transparency in terms of, do they disclose an editor or some sort of journalist that stands behind it? Do they even disclose a postal address? Can you see who's behind that? We looked at something we called advertisement dependency, also from what we can see on the website. Do they appear to be funded through advertisement or other sources of income such as print editions, donations, shops, and subscription models? And yeah, so the indicator would be if you're from minus 10 to plus 10, you're most dependent on advertisement with plus 10. And then tendency is... where we looked at the homepage categories, still not content, homepage categories, to look at how much this is immediately discernible for the audience, how right-wing, how partisan they actually are. Encoded this in partisan categories, non-conventional, and conventional categories. And for conventional categories, we've basically looked at, what do the most used online news media in these countries, what kind of categories do they have? And then we sort of, if they had the same, we checked conventional, and everything in between that wasn't clear partisan or conventional was called non-conventional. And we argue that these sort of can give an idea about how normalizing, how much sort of these sites try to sort of mimic a normal news site, right? And just here to show what tendency means, for example, here for German PI news, you can see their categories are pretty straightforward. It's migration, crime, Islam, the left, the old media, and activism. While another alternative media in Germany called Junge Freiheit has politics, economics, culture, science or knowledge, debate. You know? So, I mean, this would be two extreme points of how we understood that tendency variable. And if you look at country means, I'm not going to talk about all of them, but just some interesting aspects is that we can see that the where the ecologies are less established, that is in Denmark and in the UK, that's also where we have, on average, the sites that are most clearly partisan on the outward appearance, right? We do not have very significant sort of country differences in terms of transparency, but what is interesting maybe for the one remaining Sweden in the audience is that Sweden does stand out in terms of that what we call advertisement dependency. So the Swedish sites do actually have a very, very diverse funding structure as is discernible on the website, much more than the other countries in that sense that on what we interpreted as a way, that they're actually sort of... That for alternative media, this is a very solid funding structure. You don't have to rely on people actually. I mean, it's always sort of critical. Do people actually want to pay for advertising on your site? Is it just a sort of crazy advertisement that doesn't pay well, right? So that we can see in Sweden that they have a dedicated user base that sort of subscribes and donates. So, but that being said, really what is at stake here is that we have very, very substantial within country heterogeneity, right? Sort of, I mean, yeah, you have differences between countries, but really we can see different types of these sites in all countries. Here, I just took tendency and transparency for this graph. You don't have to, don't start reading the individual sites, just to sort of the overall picture that we have, apart from conventional sites that are non-transparent, which are not very frequent. We have examples of everything. But what we also see is, so I actually went back now for the presentation, but is this still 1 year later, what would I do now? And I can, what we can see is that it's already happened a pull towards the normalized category, conventional transparent side, and that's getting stronger and stronger. So within that year, Breitbart has changed their categories, so we would have classified them as conventional now. So did Danish news big networks and a small site in US called Information Liberation. So they have changed the news labels in that sense in that time span. So the argument would be, or the hypothesis, that yeah, there is a general trend towards more normalized appearance. Well, the second stage in the research then is one of transnational networking. And well, why would we think that right-wing alternative media would network? And what we understand network is here hyperlinked to other sources. We have actually talked about this in other presentations about hyperlinking practices, right? Very quickly, I would say, it's a communication strategy or journalistic strategy. It's to enhance own reputation and credibility by referring to more credible or credible sources or any kind of sources. So this is a practice we see on these sites, that they really sort of are very, very prone actually to sort of hyperlink to other sources to back up the argument. And the other argument it's a movement strategy. They still sort of perceive themselves as like part of a larger movement, and it's about common agenda setting, putting the real important issue on top, community building, identity formation, that they sort of, want to create visibility. We also know that transnational linking is particularly important to those groups that face national refusal and restrictions. So that would be the argument actually in those that could also lead to differences between countries. If it's hard for you to come out nationally, maybe that would be an incentive to transnational network. We actually can see it's the other way around. I will show this in a second. But basically, the argument is these hyperlink networks, they're not coincidental. They express some sort of strategic linking practice that we can interpret. And also, if we talk about right-wing actors, they also, especially the transnational question, fits into this larger question of how is the right wing starting to transnationally network, right? Just two examples, we have Steve Bannon, recently sort of announcing that he wanted to create a movement in Europe and expand to Europe, sort of to rival an anti-Soros movement. And we have on the more traditional political sphere, we have right-wing populist parties now announced that after the NP election will form a larger alliance, will try to be more coherent in cooperation. So the question is, okay, is this also something we could see for the right-wing alternative media, this sort of right-wing networking? The research question, and that I maybe should say this is ongoing, the second stage, but so we're looking at whether we can find national and transnational collections between these sites in our sample, and we're also looking at if we can see, we call them international integrators, I don't know if that's but the best term, but for now, but what additional actors can we see that actually sort of integrate that network on a secondary level? And of course, our research is limited by the fact that we're still looking at these 70 sites. So if one of these countries has massive transnational links to a country we don't have in our sample, we will right now not be able to see that at this stage. So we have to just take our group and look at what's happening. And we're looking at hyperlinks from homepage content, and that is sort of extracted from the articles themselves, but it needs to be hyperlinks. In 3 months in the course of in summer 2018, again, using the Media Cloud database, and from the total of 12 million links, we had 23,000 hyperlinks that sort of linked our 70 sites. Did the same for tweets, but I'm not going to... here it says 1 month. We're in the process of doing the data for 3 months period as well, which is more robust, but where we're looking at the same linkages in tweets. And we, basically looking, okay, the sites, where do they come from, where, and to which country, I mean, sort of pooling on country level, where do they start, in which country, and where do they link to. And what we can see, basically, the first thing is that, I mean, it sounded maybe impressive with the 23,000. It's a bit disappointing because 21,000 are national links in the U.S. And we checked our data again and again. And, I mean, I guess it's a hyperlinking practice that is very prominent in the U.S. Of course, we have also many sites from the U.S. and they're most active, but still, I mean, this is pretty astonishing. So if you then see the other numbers, there's actually not that many links on the other sites. So, but if you still look at them, and now I will just focus on whether they're national or transnational, we can see that this is actually quite different in the countries. I mean, in the U.S., we basically out of these 21,000, 29 links go abroad, right, to these sites. And sure, they might also, because we only have, it's obviously only the 5 countries, but still, I think that's pretty low. While in the U.K. and Denmark, there's basically no national links. And the other countries, Austria, Germany, and Sweden, are sort of, they're predominantly national, so they have a national network amongst these sites in terms of hyperlinking, but will still also include transnational linkages to various degrees, as you can see here. What we do see is that, we have a tight interaction between Austria and Germany, not surprisingly because of language, and that the countries, if they link to other countries, it's predominantly sites in the U.S. as a big hub, and also the Swedish sites that actually have still received some links from, for example, Austrian, German, and Danish news sites. So these are sort of the ones that pull. And this is what that table looks as a network graph. You can see sort of purple is the U.S. National network. It obviously dominates the scene pretty much. And we can still see that light blue is the Swedes and light green is the Germans, that there is national networks forming in these two countries. And these are also the two countries where we sort of have expected a flourishing scene. So because of the restrictions in mainstream media. We have the orange Austrians that sort of basically just latch on to the German network, and we have the Danish and the UK sites in red. You can maybe not really even discern them. They're only 3, and they basically have no links. And the Danish sites have some transnational links to Sweden and the US. I actually don't know when I start, so I don't know how bad I'm in time-wise, but I'll wrap up here with the last thing that is about the international integrators. And what we did here was we had we looked at mutual reference domains and looked at how many of our sites did link to a given domain, but also to account for the transnationality. It wasn't enough if only one sites from one country linked to this domain, but we took into consideration the more countries were linking, or sites from more countries were linking to this domain, the indicator score would go up, right? And it goes from 0 to 1. Sort of the higher score, the more the quantity, but also in terms of quality, international transnationality would be higher. This is the top 100 sites based on homepage content for these integrators. And in gray, you can see sort of platforms like Facebook and Twitter. We haven't looked into individual domains, so these are just sort of, they're in this context rather uninteresting. You can see a couple of the alternative news sites in our sample marked in red, but what is white and what is interesting are basically legacy media outlets, most of them. The New York Times, Washington Post, Daily Mail, etc., etc. So this is what we see that these sites have in common, that they will link to these news sites. And if you look at this on Twitter, we have a very different picture. it gets more red, as you can see, and that means that the links that we see in Twitter are actually much more between the alternative news sites. They still link to legacy news media sites, but the dominant linking practice here is that what I would call a movement practice, right? That sort of shared visibility, common support, like look what these sites do in other countries, while on the website it's clearly like a measure of credibility of sort of trying to sort of link back to legacy media sources. I guess, I don't know, how am I doing?
It's fine.
It's fine? Okay.
You do the sum up as you prefer.
As summing up sort of states, I've said it before. What we try to show, or what we hope we can show, is that, yeah, context matters, but as often in these sort of very Helen and Machine-inspired studies, the reality is more blurry, and especially because of the transnationality aspect. We have well-established news ecologies in Sweden, Germany, and the U.S., but we also have substantial heterogeneity within countries, and I would expect that once we start looking at content, that heterogeneity will come out even more. These sites are very different. Almost also, even in Denmark, not one site is like the other. And yeah, we have a normalization trend. We have a very strong American network that serves as the American sites serve as a hub function, but we still, at least in Sweden and Germany, have also national networks that are quite significant. With the international integrators, we can show that sort of these, and this argument has been made before, right, how important it is for these sites to actually also link to legacy mass media. And it's, of course, a bit contradictory, right? I mean, you position you against the media mainstream, but then you use these sites over and over again to back your own story, sort of. I mean, I don't know if, Caroline, if you start doing interviews with them, I would like to know what they think about that contradiction, right? And that in Twitter we have that more movement kind of linkages. Finally, what's next? Well, what we hope to do is to, or I actually personally want to look at it. These are not that many articles that are transnational. What is it actually? What is the content? What is the dynamic? Which articles are being shared transnationally off these sites? And I'm doing, as you know, a Danish case study where I'm looking at the Danish election right now. But also, and that's, I hope if we see each other again in Malmö or in Cardiff, I hope I have some results on sort of where I want to look at a term that Christopher Holt proposes to look at how anti-systemic actually the content is on these news sites, sort of begging to the question, how alternative are these alternative media actually? How much do they actually position themselves against a hegemony or a political mainstream? Yes, thank you.
Have a brief discussion before, and I believe there are many comments here. I'd like just to make a brief comment on this impressive cross-cultural project. In terms of the method and the hyperlinking, have you looked into the works of Helle Sjövag and her team? Because they have one article in Digital Journalism on the Scandinavian news ecology. Mm-hmm. But we have also had the pleasure of organizing some activities with them here. And these are scholars that you're familiar with. Helle leads the team, and others involved are mm-hmm. Mario Heim, mm-hmm. Rolf Ferrer, Michael Colson and Costa, mm-hmm. and Aske Kammer. Mm-hmm. And we had one seminar here at Oslo Met where kind of key point of departure was how to work with data in kind of tracing the networks and mm-hmm. the hyperlinking practices. And I don't recall all of the problems that we were discussing at the point, but there are so many challenges in doing this. And given that both of your projects yeah. are doing similar things, mm-hmm. It could be well yeah, worth I've... kind of meeting with each other. Mm-hmm. And we are happy that, because they are from Stavanger, mm-hmm. Kolstad, Copenhagen, yeah. they think it's quite natural to meet at Oslo Met. So, since you will be working a bit in collaborating with Carolina and yeah. Tina, we could perhaps try to coordinate so that
That'd
they
be great,
come
yeah.
and have a sort of methods-oriented mm-hmm. seminar, and also have one on alternative media.
Oh, that sounds like
because
a great idea.
Yes. To have you back.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to come back.
Yes. I have comments on the concept of advertising dependency later with programmatic advertising. But I think I want to open the floor. And Adam was the first to raise the hand. And Carolina.
Okay, so I have a question. Do you also study kind of extreme right-wing sources, like Olivia's daughter or some other?
Yeah,
nice,
I mean,
nice
yes, so.
They were included in this, right? But not all of them were like this, or was it like mostly...
No, I mean, and well, we include the Danish Stormer is included. Nordfund is included. The Swedish side. Well, some of them are included. I mean, they're included if they fulfill the criterion of alternative, right? And I mean, sure, you can say if you're fascist, you're alternative by definition because if they don't have that sort of self-understanding on their side, we wouldn't have included them. And then also,
choose them as alternative.
Well, and we looked at their about sections and their social media sort of about sections on Facebook and Twitter, and if we found any element of sort of like, okay, we are anti-establishment, we're here to tell the real truth, we show you the things you don't see, then we would have classified them as alternative. So it's not us that sort of, and I know, I mean, this is in a critical point, right? Because we might lose some, but the other thing is, okay, we'd say, okay, we only rely on our expertise, on our, that we sort of know once they're alternative. So we chose this approach to be sort of a bit more systematic, but I'm sure, I mean, some are not very, you feel, I mean, I had have examples where I felt, okay, shouldn't that sort of be included? But they really didn't say anything about that. So then they weren't. And for the real extremist sides, some of them are. Another thing is that they're still often very movement based in their sort of. They will be often look like movement homepages more than like news sites. They will have articles, and that would be also a criterion where if it didn't like give the appearance of a news site, we wouldn't have taken it.
Did you also study the language, or did you just study?
No. As of now, this is structural or sort of unlinking. So the content part is, yeah, on the horizon. I mean, it would be as.
One of my PhD students has just finished his PhD, which is a study of the extreme, actually, the kind of violent extreme language. It was really terrible. I'm sure he needs to have therapy now, but. Unfortunately, but he did a lot of
okay, interesting. I mean, I will point it out to my colleagues because I mean, I'm not involved in a sub project on the European election that they're doing, and they're looking at Poland actually in that project as well. So, I'll mention that.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. This is great, and I think the element that you bring in with these comparative issues really. You know, it's so complicated also because since we're struggling with, you know, how to classify, this idea of also trying to compare makes it, you know, it's an even, you know, another layer of it. Because one way to compare as well to see the alternative versus the professional or the established would, of course, be to see some of these elements from an established news organization and an alternative news organization. Look at linking factors, for instance, you know, how they differ in that kind of sense. So that would, of course, offer something different in a comparative perspective. For instance, you have to actually look at, okay, so what kind of content is published? How does it compare? Can you then call it partisan, for instance, or does it have an alternative language, or does it, you know, these kind of issues? But I was thinking also about what you said about, you know, why, how come they often link also to established media sites. And I think it's be really interesting to go into these, you know, what kind of links are they and how are they contextualized when they're linked. Because in one way, you know, it could be that they're linking when they're criticizing.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's, look at what this journalist, you know, what, in the interviews that I did, it's like, yeah, we go after media profile. So when this journalist writes something, we go after this journalist. Or it could be, which I often also think is the case, that this position as alternative, whereas media critics, is also strategic. you know, there's a market there, and you can say that you are very critical or that you want to be an alternative, but you're very much dependent on what's going on in the world. Even from the extremist sides that look at, you know, this Nazi sides in Norway, you know, they're constantly relate to what is happening in the wider kind of news ecology, because they're also news producers. So, you know, everyone's kind of inspired by each other, but it kind of goes one way, though, most of the time. So I think, you know, to use these kind of links and then go deeper into the material and then compare, that would be really, really interesting comparative project.
Yeah.
Because what are the kinds of links that all of these are?
Yeah.
You know, these kind of stories that they, many of these sites, for instance, share so that would be...
No. Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that's because... But what I mean, I look into this a bit for the Danish sites, and what I can... I mean, it's not... I mean, there at least, it's predominantly not as support, but sort of like as reframing, right? I mean, so it's not sort of, hey, see, this article is totally crazy, and what is this? But they would, for example, a classic example in Denmark would be they link to a commentary on Berlinske, which is the leading right... not right wing, but left of the right of the political middle newspaper, quality newspaper in Denmark. So there would be some, because they have in the debate section, they bring out quite diverse people, also sometimes quite right wing people. Then it's like, see, like they also have people that say that there's too much immigration or Islam should be limited or something. And then, or they will sort of just pick and choose from these articles. So this is, I'm sure there's some of the sort of see how crazy this is what they write in mainstream media, but there's also a lot of element that is sort of this sort of reframing and using backing. I think this would be really interesting to study because this is where the alternative problematic really comes to the fore.
Place for trying to also put up these categories to see the movement. Because I think actually one central element of alternative media is this kind of movement. While established organizations are very stable, they don't change in terms of what they've been writing, you know, about themselves, for instance, or how. So this is also kind of an element. It'd be interesting to see, you know, when you move into the direction towards more kind of normalization.
What happens?
You stay there.
Totally. Yeah. But it also makes it difficult because it's such a moving target, right?
Yeah.
Longitudinal.
But really nearly impossible for some of these. And some of them, maybe because of their anti-systemness, don't stay far right. They, you know, whoever they're against changes.
Yes, so exactly, yeah. I mean...
But sorry, I think I jumped on Chris.
Yeah, Chris.
Chris.
No, thanks. I find it really, really fascinating. I think also, I love this idea that's being raised about, what are these hyperlinks doing because of... They're sort of, by definition, if you're going to claim your alternative, you have to have a constitutive other. So, which is why, like, The Guardian and all these ones, like, I might suspect that's sort of what Fox News is linked to.
Yeah, sure.
That's sort of in a supportive sort of maybe that. But I have another question just about the digital ecology, which gets to it, which what I found interesting when you were talking about them sort of and the financing. Because one of the things that I love the digital ecology metaphor, and what I don't like is when it's sort of, and you haven't at all, by the way, but some people misuse it, they critique ecology because they say, it's this idea that everything has to be in homeostasis and sort of right, like, balance. No, ecologies are like really brutal, nasty things, right? Like, that's why you use ecology as a metaphor to replicate like the real world. And when you see these groups, like in Germany and Sweden, what I'm wondering is, because like the news ecology is a very cutthroat ecology, because business comes from other news organizations, right? Like, so if you want to get funding, like, not necessarily by definition, but you're not, and of course we've seen more collaborations of late, which is actually also a response to financial pressures. But point is, like, within a smaller sort of ecology, you're not, you know, if you're the New York Times, like, maybe the same person is at the New subscribes to the New York Times and the Washington Post, but odds are they're competitors. And they view themselves as, you know, competitors doing the same thing, but still competitors. And what I'm wondering financially with these groups, like if they're all linking to each other and saying what wonderful things they do, they sound less like a news organization as a social, as opposed to like more of a social movement. Because social movements are supportive of each other and their groups, right? They don't fight for attention in the same way. Whereas news organizations, it's all about the exclusive. It's all about the, right? Like that's a whole part of journalistic practice, is sort of marking yourself out as superior to your... So what I'm wondering is, maybe you haven't, because you haven't looked, like, how much of it is more like a social movement and how much of it is more like journalism?
I think that's a very good question. And it varies, you know. And I sometimes don't know, but I speculate that. That varies for themselves. I mean, yes, they want to, because they still have, they have a motivation. That's, they're not out there for making money. I mean, they have a mission, right? And if they see sort of, they still have, this movement aspect is there. But on the other hand, you can also see that, it's not that they're linking to each other like crazy. I mean, it's not that they're really cooperating or doing things together. I mean, it's not on that level where you would really call, I wouldn't say they're on a movement level, because they still sort of, I guess sometimes, and they also, some are a bit more dirty kids than others, you know, so sometimes the one like would say, okay, yeah, we're like the proper one of the right-wing alternative, and these are just like, these are like fake news or something. So in a sense, but still sometimes they might need each other also just to advance, or like, is a credible or another source, because they don't have many resources, most of them, right? So I mean, the content needs to come somewhere. So even if it's if it appears to be a movement strategy, it might also just be based on these hyperlinks. Okay, we need to fill this site. Okay, and now we read that the competition has had something. Now we also have to have it, and we reframe it, for example. So I guess my gut feeling would be that the movement element is rather undertone, but I can totally see that this is sort of a very interesting divide that they cross, right?
One final comment.
It's somewhat quick. I found this fascinating. I love the comparative element, and I think I'm thinking through like how this will help me. I don't look just at the right, but just the challenge of capturing this stuff is complex. But one thing that sort of occurred to me as you were going through, and I think the links, I think you're spot on with the links to mainstream, and you can see like Rasmussen Reports gets linked to, well, they're the favorable polling, Republican favorable polling outlet, right? So you can imagine why that's happening, you can imagine why The Guardian's being hate-linked and all of this, but one with some of the ones, particularly...
Today.
You don't have to pull them up, no, it's fine. No, I was thinking with some of your sites that you're looking at, your far right or alternative sites that are in your cases, you're probably missing some intermedia linking that's not hyperlinked. So Breitbart, for instance, uses a lot of wire stories and just reframes the headline as a way to fill their site. So there is a something that's not being caught up in the hyperlink scraping, which I use, my students do a discourse analysis of a Breitbart page, which is just running a wire story with a Breitbart headline, and they find, of course, horrible things, like they do discourse, and they find that it's an awful telling of a story, and there's misogyny here, racism there, but they don't process that it's just a wire story being repackaged very minimally on a Breitbart site. So there's a lot of complexity that... I'm just making your job harder, I know.
No,
but I think there's a lot that's not going to be captured in hyperlinking.
And I totally agree. And this is the problem, because, I mean, in the US sites are actually very good in hyperlinking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Danish sites pretty much don't hyperlink. I mean, I know how these articles look. They put the source, they don't set the link, right? So, I mean, we're working on sort of how to extract it, but it's obviously very tricky. So, yeah, a methodological sort of workshop on how you do that. I mean, because you have to sort of, what are you looking for? Sort of sources in the material, right, that you can clearly make out that are not hyperlinked. I mean, it gets tricky, but that I totally agree, because you're losing a lot in that picture, and you're measuring also sort of a hyperlinking culture on a comparative level, you know, as you could see, because there are so many in the US.
Or even just at an in-group language, right? So if I say, well, Brett Maryland said da-da-da-da-da, I didn't say that it was Fox News, but everyone in that crowd would know that that's what the reference is. So that's...
No.
Good luck.
Thank you, Eva.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we are, of course, going to quit. I just want to take a small opportunity to ask something. And that's that the article that Tine presented with Christopher Holt and Diana Friesisch is something I commissioned last May, June, after meeting Lena in Münster and knowing Christopher from such line of work previously, and also, of course, Tina. And I then had in mind that possibly this could be sort of a point of departure for a special issue in the future. In the meantime, Christopher has done another sort of special issue on the journal, but it's not like they've emptied out the field.
No.
And also, in the meantime, Reuters Institute have really sized up their emphasis on alternative media in the survey that's in the field now. So in the next report coming out now, I think in next week or 1.5 weeks, there will be a lot about alternative news media. So like you have data from lots of countries. And it began, of course, here in Scandinavia and the UK with some measures. So we have many members of or associated people to digital journalism here. What would be your viewpoint on sort of the potential of a special issue? What would be most exciting and worthwhile if one was to do something that looks at alternative media in some way? In relation to digital journalism? Huh?
All of us?
No, I'm not.
I'm asking
a question to all of you in terms of, like, given how all of our discussions have been and also following Eva's presentation now, like, what would you say would be, that we know enough about, but this would be really exciting to work more on?
I would say alternative to what? Right? This is the recurring theme, like, this is an anti-systemist, or it's a right against the center and the left. You know that there's an alternative towards something, and this is something that came up in my PhD, where someone said, "Why isn't this alternative media?" I said, well, it wasn't clear. There wasn't with WikiLeaks at the time. There wasn't a clear articulation that it was a media against another media. It was a media against power, and that was too nebulous in the way they were describing it, so it wasn't easy to describe it as alternative media. But you know, these things change and move. So this idea of alternativeness needs some, it's an alternative to what? And that goes from the far right to the core periphery argument to, you know, other ways of conceptualizing this. So that would, I mean,
and
I'm not
bringing in an audience perspective. Eddie?
I would say, like Chris does, this is not my area of expertise, obviously, but one thing that I was discussing with Eva was that, and this is actually I wanted to ask her later, because your sample was 150 sites, and then you kind of narrowed that down to 70-something.
Yeah.
And then I was just wondering, what's the other 70?
Yes.
So, because in Venezuela we have a case of what I would say is something similar to this, but if the it's on the left wing, aporrea.org, for instance, it is supported of the government. It's not really anti-establishment, but it's actually perpetuating, doesn't sort of say political views of it, but it's actually just providing pretty much the same sort of format and evidence. So that's why I was asking whether it was rather than alternative populist media, or perhaps digital populist media, instead of alternative. So, because you can actually just bring there a whole range of left-wing news organizations, alternative populist media that are also doing the same for very different reasons, which are worth studying, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of heterogeneity. Yes. I think that's a common thread in some of these.
So what I was asking, what's the making of the rest of the 150 sites?
I mean, they're not left-wing, you know, I mean, because obviously the 150 were already a pretty educated guess.
Yes.
So it was really just to sort of sort out blocks. They're interesting. I mean, this is we have to start somewhere, right? But there's a lot of the ecology that's missing, and then it would, besides that, we're not clear cut right wing. But but it's tricky. But mostly the ones that mostly disappeared were based on because they qualified as a block. Because these were also being named very much, right? But back to your question, I think we can go and think about sort of the conceptual stuff, and I totally agree. But I guess maybe it would also be interesting sort of start looking at practices, right? I mean, what are they doing sort of in terms of hyperlinking and content empirical, but I do agree that the conceptual question of alternativeness is still very much unanswered, and we need, because I argue for that we need to keep the, I mean, I don't want to lose alternative, but I do argue that it needs to be on more solid ground, and I
perhaps
mean...
Perhaps the special edition is just conceptualizing the term, you know, what is it called? Is it alternative media, or is it, you know, popular media, or, you know, perhaps that's the purpose of the special edition.
I don't think the whole special edition, that article lays some fundament, and then, of course, one could build and synthesize more. But I would like to see a lot of empirical work too. I think there is a very important common denominator in the epistemic practice of alternative media that we don't know too much about, but Christopher Holt and some others have really followed how they work in producing the news and their truth claims and how they're imitating. And that really aligns a lot with what we've talked about here, and Edson's keynote and the imitation practices of fake news and such. So in many ways, there's much to learn, I think, about these imitation practices and kind of how close you get to journalism and where they differ. I think Edson had a comment back here, and then Chris. Oh, you did not? Okay, Chris.
No, I think probably just as as an audience, I always have this audience thing to frame it as the question. And like sort of when you said you could have an audience perspective, I'm like, where do you start from that? Because why are all these things actually existing, right? Like there has to be a demand. Without an audience, these things don't exist. Yeah. And I'm not saying you would make it all about audiences, but if your point of view for framing a special issue is trying to make sense, why are all these things actually existing? Like obviously you have a mainstream. Obviously there was enough people in multiple countries who aren't happy with what they're getting.
Yeah, so actually you were mentioning
who now are turning to these things and more pop up, right? Yeah. And then maybe they compete, maybe they are more like a movement, or maybe they're more like a network. Who knows? It varies by country. But if my sense of framing, like what would be interesting to find out, because then of course you can look at like how do they link to the mainstream? How do they position themselves against the mainstream? How do they frame truth debates? How do they cover big issues? You can still take a very producer-based perspective, but the reason you're trying to figure out is answering the fundamental question, like, what is allowing these things to succeed?
Absolutely.
And you could also have a finance perspective on it. You could also, I would love to see something about the business models.
There are a lot of questions. Knowing my editorial board, our editorial board, there will probably be some like, this is too diverse, you're trying to capture everything, you need more focus. But for sure, there are many multiple layers that we need to have. Now I have some other questions.
No, the thing is related to what Scott just said is maybe the concept that we should be interested in is the alternativeness, not the specific alternative media, because that varies in different contexts. Like in Singapore, if you say alternative media, it's very different from what would you consider as alternative media in the US or in Sweden or in Denmark. I think the principle is alternativeness. It might be alternative to what, but I think looking at these nuances of what different media contexts consider as alternative to what, I think it would be quite rich for us to be able to see that what's alternative in this context might be called the same way in other contexts, but mean very, very different. Like in Singapore, there's no... The alternative media is because they're online and they're not affiliated with one of the two main media conglomerates. That makes an alternative in terms of content. In terms of political leaning, they're still very similar with what we would call mainstream there.
Cool. Has anyone tried to investigate linguistic properties of text in alternative media compared to mainstream media?
No. Everyone should.
not in a large way, but in a small way. I've written about how their discourse is much more... They embrace sort of like a sort of assholeness, let's call it that. Where like there's a specific, but it varies because you do have a normalizing discourse as well, where some are trying to professionalize and seem more mainstream. And after certain moments of failure, they sort of move away from being the jerks in the room to being a little more professional in their dialogue. So these things, and I'm not looking at the right per se, which is kind of a much different discourse, but even in the left or the leftish, that they take joy in pushing back against the idea that news needs to be presented in a sort of stable, stoic voice, right? So there's some of that.
Yes, there's so, I don't want to be an asshole to you, nor an asshole to our very helpful camera staff and our staff helping us with the catering. So I think we should, it's my own fault starting this discussion.
And let's continue.